This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Muslim Chaplaincy Conversation at ORFM Dunedin.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of God, most gracious, most merciful. Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be with you in Arabic. My name is Arina Aizal, and I'll be your host for the Muslim Chaplaincy Conversation. In today's episode, we have a talk on Taliban victory in Afghanistan, a light at the end of the tunnel, or another dark chapter. And an interview with Dr. Rula Talahma, Senior Advisor for Refugee and Migrant Education at Ministry of Education. We begin, though, with the recitation of the Quran by Sheikh Mishari Al-Fash, chapters 49, verses 6 to 10.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu in ja'akum fasiqun binaba'in fatabayyanu an tusibu qawman bijahalatin fatusbihu ala ma fa'altum nadimin wa'lamu anna fikum rasulallah لو يطيعكم في كثير من الأمر لعنتم ولكن الله حبب إليكم الإيمان وزينه في قلوبكم وكره إليكم الكفر والفسوق والعصيان أولئك هم الراشدون فَضْلًا مِنَ اللَّهِ وَنِعْمَةً وَاللَّهُ عَلِيمٌ حَكِيمٌ وَإِنْ طَائِفَتَانِ مِنَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ اقْتَتَلُوا فَأَصْلِحُوا بَيْنَهُمَا فَإِنْ بَغَتْ إِحْدَاهُمَا عَلَى الْأُخْرَى فَقَاتِلُوا الَّتِي تَبْغِي حَتَّى تَفِيءَ إِلَى أَمْرِ اللَّهِ فَإِنْ فَاءَتْ فَأَصْلِحُوا بَيْنَهُمَا بِالْعَدْلِ وَأَقْسِطُوا إن الله يحب المقسطين إنما المؤمنون إخوة فأصلحوا بين أخويكم واتقوا الله لعلكم ترحمون.
Translation of the recited verse. In the name of God, most gracious, most merciful. Believers, if a troublemaker brings you news, check it first, in case you wrong others unwillingly, and later regret what you have done. And be aware that it is God's messenger who is among you. If he obeyed you, in many cases you would certainly suffer. God has endeared faith to you and made it beautiful to your hearts. He has made disbelief, mischief, and disobedience hateful to you. It is people like this who are rightly guided through God's favor and blessings. God has the knowledge to decide. If two groups of the believers fight, you, believers, should try to reconcile them. If one of them oppresses the other, fight the oppressors until they submit to God's command. Then make a just and even-handed reconciliation between two of them. God loves those who are even-handed. The believers are brothers, so make peace between your two brothers and be mindful of God, so that you may be given mercy. In this section of the program, Dr. Najib Lafray talks about Taliban victory in Afghanistan, a light at the end of the tunnel, or another dark chapter.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Afghanistan has been at the grip of war and instability for the past 43 years, ever since the Afghan communists launched their coup in April 1978, followed by the Soviet invasion at the Christmas Eve of 1979. The removal of the Taliban government by the U.S. and its allies after the 9/11 terrorist attacks raised the hopes that finally Afghans will be able to enjoy peace and security. The expectation was that the U.S. forces remove the Taliban government, dismantle Al-Qaeda, and then leave the country. That was hoped to be followed by the arrival of international assistance to support the newly formed Afghan government and to alleviate the general population's suffering. Unfortunately, it did not happen that way. The international aid did come, but what trickled down after the donor contractors, subcontractors, and corrupt officials took the lion's share benefited only a small segment of the society. The miseries of the majority continued, and the socioeconomic inequality reached unprecedented heights. As for the American and NATO troops, they overstayed their welcome, and their numbers kept rising. The quote-unquote mistakes they made and the atrocities they committed gave a new lease of life to the Taliban. The Taliban, who seemed almost completely annihilated in 2002, re-emerged as a fighting force and a liberation movement by 2005 and 2006. Instead of dealing with the roots of the problem, the American response was to increase the number of troops, reaching 140,000 in 2011 and 2012. I wrote an opinion piece for the International Herald Tribune in September 2006. The title they chose for my article sums up my views and arguments. And the title was, "The Way Out is to Get Out." The way out is to get out. Imagine the thousands of lives and billions of dollars that would have been saved if the withdrawal of foreign troops had happened 15 years ago. Thus, President Biden's decision to leave Afghanistan was only an acknowledgement of the inevitable. But the way it took place was a disgrace, probably worse than what had happened in Vietnam some 4.5 decades earlier. After evacuating their largest military base, the Bagram Airfield, and I quote from a news report, by shutting off the electricity and slipping away in the dark of the night without notifying the base's Afghan commander, who discovered the Americans' departure more than 2 hours after they left. End of quote. After that, about 5,000 U.S. troops were deployed at Kabul Airport to assist with the evacuation of civilian foreigners and the Afghans who had helped the foreign forces. By this time, the Taliban had entered Kabul, and the panic-stricken Afghans rushed to the airport. Encouraged by the rumors that the Americans would take away anyone who could get inside the airport. Those rumors were not completely baseless. I know of more than a dozen people who managed to get out without meeting any of the criteria that were set for evacuation. The number may reach thousands. Of course, their rush created problems for the people whose lives were really in danger. We all saw on our TV screens, the mayhem and the beatings that took place outside the airport. They were blamed on the Taliban. But according to an eyewitness, it was the way that the Americans organized, if we can use that word, the evacuation that contributed to the chaos, and it was the CIA-trained Afghan Special Forces. CIA-trained Afghan Special Forces, and they had formed a buffer between the Taliban and the foreign troops who did most of the beating. The suicide attack that happened near the airport gate, killing 13 American soldiers, in addition to more than 150 Afghans, can be seen as a parting gift of Afghanistan to the U.S. A few days later, the Americans delivered their own parting gift in the form of a drone attack which killed 10 civilians, including 6 children. How could the Taliban reach Kabul 2 weeks before the completion of the withdrawal of the foreign troops? This is an important topic that needs detailed analysis beyond the scope of a short essay. Suffice it to say that the corruption of the American-supported government and the prevailing insecurity around the country were two major factors. Taliban victory again raised the hopes for an end to war and instability and return of normal, peaceful life in the country. Of course, the memories of the Taliban rule in the second half of the 1990s cast a dark shadow over their future. But the hope was, and to some extent still is, that they have learned from their past mistakes and have changed their behavior. The rhetoric of their spokesmen and the promises they made were very encouraging. Their behavior has changed to some extent as well. For example, I was pleasantly surprised to see the Taliban not only allowing the Ashura commemoration to take place, but some of their leaders participating in those ceremonies. There have been a lot of negative reports about the Taliban in the Western media and a lot of positive reports in the Arab media. Both seem somewhat exaggerated to me. The Westerners mourn the demise of what they consider as women's rights and human rights. That's why the media here focuses on the concerns and stories related to those issues, mostly without confirming their authenticity. It's true that some excesses have taken place and some atrocities have been committed, but not to the extent that we are told. It's also true that the Taliban have curtailed the license to immorality that was issued by the previous government, and they have imposed some strict rules on dress code and gender segregation. Seen from the Western lens, they are harsh and uncalled for. For majority of Afghans, including women, though they are either welcome or of lesser concern. Their main concern is, after being able to feed their family, their safety, security, and dignity. The Taliban have said that women can return to their past jobs once the conditions allow. And some female doctors, journalists, and airport police officers are already at work. They have also allowed a high level of freedom of speech. The public and private TVs have stopped what the Taliban and probably many Afghans see as morally corrupting programs, but they are operating and sometimes broadcasting reports critical of the Taliban. As for the Arab media, I sympathize with them celebrating the end of occupation in Afghanistan and the removal of the corrupt and morally corrupting government. However, the Taliban have not done much to get out of the dark shadow of the 1990s. Firstly, as mentioned earlier, there are credible reports of Taliban beating reporters and women and killing military personnel of previous regime. Secondly, to me, after reaching Kabul and making the right noises, there were two tests for the Taliban, in both of which they have failed so far. The first test was how they would deal with the issue of Panjshir, the only province that was out of their control when they captured Kabul. Panjshir has a special place in Afghan history for putting stiff resistance under famous commander Ahmad Shah Massoud against the Soviet invasion in the 1980s and against the Taliban rule in the 1990s. Ahmad Shah Massoud's son, Ahmad Massoud, together with some of his father's aides, took shelter in Panjshir after the fall of Kabul. They announced that they did not want war, but because of what the Taliban had done in the past, they could not trust them. They wanted to talk to the Taliban to gain some reassurances. After two rounds of talks, however, the Taliban launched a massive attack from several directions and were able to brutally crush the resistance. Ahmad Massoud and his supporters withdrew to the mountains and called for national uprising. The Taliban attack faced strong criticism from the Afghan ulama, religious scholars, some of them staunch supporters of the Taliban. Earlier, they had offered their mediation, reminding both parties of the verse of the Noble Quran, and it's verse 9 of chapter 49, quote, "If two groups of the believers fight, you believers should try to reconcile them." And the verse goes on. Unfortunately, the Taliban did not take the offer, preferring the use of force with the excuse that the negotiations had failed. The ulama's response was, "You could talk to the kafirs, non-believers, namely the Americans, for 2 years. Couldn't you allow the talks with your Muslim brothers to go on even for 2 months? The other test to me was the shape of the Taliban government. Their spokesman had promised over and over the formation of an inclusive government. However, when it was announced, it was anything but inclusive. No one expected, nor would have they welcomed, the inclusion of members of the former government. But the expectation was that the government would include non-Taliban personalities with clean records and expertise in various fields, and that it would include members of various Afghan ethnic groups in a balanced manner. The new ministers, though, were all Taliban members, all men, and the vast majority of them belonging to only one ethnic group. Neither women nor some ethnic groups or religious minorities have any representation. The Taliban have said that this is a caretaker government to be replaced by a permanent government in a few months. So we need to wait and see what form that government would have. In brief, the Taliban victory can be a light at the end of the long tunnel of war and suffering in Afghanistan. That depends on the Taliban learning from their past mistakes, genuinely changing their harsh policies, and not insisting on monopolizing power. If not, either the national uprising will grow and Afghanistan will witness another civil war, or in case of the Taliban crushing the opposition, the country will experience the type of peace, quote-unquote, the Taliban had provided in the 1990s, described by a scholar as peace of grave. Both of these cases will mean opening of another dark chapter in Afghan history. Thank you.
Now we listen to an Afghani song about Watan, or homeland, which calls for unity and equality. Assalamualaikum, Dr. Rula Talama. Thank you for being here today on our show.
Assalamualaikum, Arina and everyone. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Would you mind introducing yourself?
Sure. We are celebrating Te Reo Māori Week, Te Wiki o Te Reo Māori. So I think it would be appropriate for me to attempt to do my pipiha in Te Reo Māori. So tēnā koutou katoa, ko Hebron toko Maunga, ko Jordan toko Awa, ko Air New Zealand toko Waka, ko Abu Safiye toko Iwi, no Parihitini, that's Palestine or Philistine, aho, ke otipoti toko Kanya, inaini tono, ko Yusef toko Matoa, ko Mahbuba toko Faia, ko Tariq Tokotani korola talahma toko enwa norira tinakoto katua. Thank you for the opportunity and thank you for having me with you today.
Thank you so much for the pepeha. I think it's very special knowing that it is Te Reo Māori week this week. And introducing yourself in Te Reo, would you mind to translate that to our listeners?
Yes, sure. So before coming to New Zealand, I used to live in Hebron, which is in the south of West Bank in Palestine. Our river there is the Jordan River, the closest. Of course, the means of transport that brought me into Aotearoa was Air New Zealand. My family name is Abu Safiye, and I take my husband's legal name, Talahma, which means from Bethlehem, so that's where he hails from. And I am Palestinian from Palestine. And currently living in Otipoti, in New Zealand, Dunedin, New Zealand. Yusuf is my father, Mahbuba, my beloved mother, and Tariq is my husband. My name is Rulat Al Ahma. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for that. And you did mention that you grew up in Palestine. Would you mind taking us through a journey and telling us about the Palestinian story?
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, thank you again. So I'm Palestinian, born to two refugees from Gaza Strip, originally hailing from a small town on the Mediterranean coast called Hamama, which translates into the pigeon. My hometown was destroyed in 1948. During the war, during the Palestinian Nakba, or the catastrophe, which made both all of my grandparents refugees into Gaza. And that's where my parents were born, which also made me a refugee to Gaza Strip. I am the eldest of eight children in my family, who are all highly have achieved and are very successful. We are five girls and three boys, including amongst them an orthopedic surgeon, an interventional radiologist, a dentist, an urban planner, a civil engineer. Well, actually three civil engineers, but we've pursued also other pathways later in life. An IT expert and entrepreneur, and a financial and administrative manager. I hope I haven't forgot any of them. And I lived my childhood during the 1980s in Gaza Strip. And later moved to the West Bank for further study. Of course, that was a different reality to what we have at the moment, or what we have in New Zealand. I've lived 7 years under the first Intifada, which is the Palestinian uprising from 1987 to 1994. And that's where I had most of my primary and secondary schooling. We were often under military curfews, so it was a norm to be at home from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. Automatically, and then for extended periods of time, especially in 1990 during the first Gulf War, which meant that most of the population were under that military curfew. But also, you know, being a descendant of refugees there, losing our ancestral land and not having much meant that we could focus on what could create a better future, which is education. So we were always focused on our schooling, working hard, studying hard, and, aspiring to become the best versions of ourselves. So I finished high school ranked top five at that time during national exams. And then I moved to the West Bank to do my first and second degree. So I did a Bachelor of Science in Civil Engineering and a Master's degree in Business Administration before coming to New Zealand and doing my PhD. Yeah, thank you.
Wow, thank you for that story. So you've lived in a Western context before coming to New Zealand. So what prompted you to move?
Yes. So, before that time that I spent in Gaza, we had a fantastic opportunity in early 1980s, mid-1980s, when my father moved to the United States to do his PhD, and we accompanied him as a family. And I think that was one of my early exposures to a Western context. I was in the ESOL class, the English for Speakers of Other Languages, as I've only had, Arabic, and I wasn't even literate in Arabic at that time at a young age. And it was one of the best discoveries, being in a very diverse class, people from across the globe, speaking different languages, having different faiths, different colors, coming together and making friendships. So that was incredibly mind-opening at a young age, which made it easier in later life to be open to knowing people and wanting to actually learn about them, about their cultures, languages, their values, and finding common grounds as well, because we do share a lot, way more than we think in our, current context. So that was just before we went back home to Gaza, before the first intifada or the first uprising. Of course, there were a lot of challenges at that time that my parents, shielded me, from, including the permissible food that we can get. So I remember my mom cooking all the time at home so we can get, halal food and keeping ourselves safe. I think Houston, Texas in the 1980s was not that quite safe, even when I reflect on our, journey in New Zealand. So there were a lot of caution about, where to go and who to talk to. Yeah. So that element is quite important, given that we are quite, safe here in New Zealand, at least compared to my first experience overseas.
Mm.
Yeah.
And that experience must have impacted you till today.
Well, absolutely. I mean, when I think of our journey here to Otipoti, Dunedin, I always reflect on the pulling and pushing factors that, made us migrate as a young family with my husband and children. So I could, talk to you about that as well as, the first pulling factor for me was how family friendly Dunedin is, the fantastic tertiary education systems we have here, organizations that we have here, in particular the University of Otago where I did my PhD, the kind and relaxed nature of the people in Dunedin, the beautiful scenery that we have around us, also being not too hot as well. So that's a great factor for people coming from the Middle East, at least for me. Not everybody will share that view, but I personally like how cool it is here. And then, of course, there were the pushing factors. So as I said, my first experience in the state was that it's not that much of a safe place. And I've also lived in very dangerous places, like my hometown, Gaza, and the West Bank, which I moved in later in life before coming to New Zealand. And also the restrictions on movements that we had during that time between those two regions, and what that meant for me as an individual and later in life as a family. So last time I was in Gaza was in 2006, unfortunately, and I haven't been able to go back there to visit any of my extended family since then.
Mm.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about the journey when you arrived to New Zealand and how all that take place?
Sure. Yeah, fascinating, I have to say. You know, you go through all the requirements for immigration in New Zealand, and you move your entire life in three suitcases and lots of hopes and aspirations. But then there are a lot of access points where you meet interesting people. So during my study, I became part of the university community as a PhD candidate, but also through schools, through my children's schools. We have lovely communities that take care of each other, that are friendly, that are welcoming. And you find that you weave those connections in schools. But also, you know, being active in the community, attending events or being part of the organizing committee for an event means that you start to build that network. Yeah, so primarily it was study that brought me here, and I've finished my PhD from the National Center for Peace and Conflict Studies here at the University of Otago. And during that time as well, I have worked full-time job while also caring for my young family and having two of them who, you know, called Dunedin home as well.
That must have been a really... Sorry.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that was really interesting. And can you please share with us about your doctorate studies? What was the findings that you found from your research?
Sure. So at the National Center for Peace and Conflict Studies, there are a lot of intersectionality with other fields of research. I mean, so I looked carefully and closely at something called bioplanning, which is a term I've used to describe practices of governing and resistance using a very unique lens of town planning in the occupied Palestinian West Bank during the peace process. So what I'm saying here is that it's a power analysis, looking at town planning as a medium to govern, to subjugate, and to control, and also a medium to resist. Of course, I've used a Western theory and methodology, which, if we remove the occupation element, could be a framework that can be used to study how, you know, in other contexts, like in New Zealand, how we do planning, how that affects our lives, and how do people participate and resist those ways of planning. And if you reflect on that, you find that we are in a continuous influx of, you know, going with the flow of power or challenging it continuously in, you know, our daily lives. But that's not it. I mean, being a PhD candidate doesn't mean that you only confine yourself to the topic or the thesis that you focus on. It's a great opportunity to actually attend a lot of workshops and a lot of training and get to know the research of other people around. So it is an opportunity to grow and to develop yourself. And I have to say that over the years, I have, found it one of the most rewarding experiences of my life to be here at the University of Otago and to get to know some of my colleagues who became close friends, and whom we now interact as they work in different capacities, in New Zealand. Yeah.
Thank you for that. And besides bioplanning, what other research that interests you?
Sure. So in a previous life, when I was doing my master's degree back in the West Bank, I worked as a research assistant with my alma mater, my previous university, which is Birzeit University. I took a lot of interest in something called the quality of life tool, which, reflecting on that now after 15 years, a lot of work has been done. It's a WHO tool to assess the quality of life of people. But at that time, we've done some research to customize the tool for people who are in war-like conditions, how it is like when you are not in a stable political atmosphere. And I can see a lot of traces of that in the different frameworks of well-being that we are using now in New Zealand. So I've been taking a lot of interest in understanding the matrix of well-being, what it means for us in New Zealand, what it means for former refugees, for migrants, for minority ethnic communities. What are the factors of success in life? What actually makes us feel well and able to engage in and participate in society? So you will see there are common grounds related to safety and security and having the basics, but then there are also other factors that makes us feel good about our lives.
That's a really good one.
So that's what interests me at the moment.
Yeah. Would you like to elaborate more on your journey while you were studying and other roles you were playing during as a student?
Of course. So, any person is not, a one-dimensional, character. We wear multiple hats all the time. So you could know someone as a parent, another as a student, another one as a public servant, another one as a community leader. But there are so many people who wear all of these hats all the time. And I have to say that I was one of those people and still. So during my PhD journey, as I mentioned, I probably took some time on and off from study while working full-time for Red Cross as a resettlement caseworker. And I was one of the first staff from Red Cross that welcomed former refugees in our town and continued in that role for another 2.5 years. All while doing my study, supporting my three children who were in school and early childhood education, and also having our fourth and fifth child here in Dunedin. There was a time when you have to structure your day in order to align your priorities, focus on what you want to achieve on that day, on those multiple fronts. I've been working with Red Cross for 2.5 years, and currently for 2 years I work with the Ministry of Education as an education advisor for refugee and migrant education. This is another very rewarding role, which enabled me to serve our communities, reach out to other agencies, and collaborate in what would make a difference in people's lives through a lens that I'm incredibly passionate about, which is education.
Mm, And it's good to know that, you know, when you have passion to do something, it makes the work really fulfilling.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us about how you got involved with Red Cross?
Sure. So I'm a native Arabic speaker and a fluent English speaker. And the first arrivals, at least in the first couple of years, were people from Syria who speak Arabic, slightly different dialect, and come from a similar culture to mine. So we share a lot of values. Bear in mind that the political situation and the history of events that made me who I am would be completely different for them. But as I mentioned, you know, I don't claim that I know it all, but, you know, it was a learning journey as well for me. And I've been, you know, helping in the community prior to joining Red Cross. So it was an incredibly rewarding and the right decision for me to, you know, apply and join the resettlement team at that time. What else? Also, it was a learning journey, as I mentioned, because understanding how Immigration New Zealand work, how the different government and local agencies collaborate together, was a very, you know, thrilling thing to watch and be involved in. And I have to say that we always do it quite uniquely here in Dunedin. We might be the guinea pig of the country in exploring few things and initiatives. And I think we have the right size of town to explore and try new things. So it's a small, big city, Dunedin is.
And it's good for networking as well, getting to know everyone in the city.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, I am mindful of my, you know, personal connections and my work connections and my study connections. Sometimes, you know, because it's a small town, you'll find that, you know, people in different capacities, you know, and that's fine as long as you are, you know, mindful of which hat you are wearing at the moment.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Would you like to elaborate more about the professional work you do in New Zealand and also back in Palestine?
Yeah, of course. So back in Palestine before, during my study and before I moved into New Zealand, I indicated earlier that I worked as a research assistant at a public health and community research institute at Bir Zeit University for nearly 3 years. I think I've learned much of my research methodologies during that time, how to do community work, how to facilitate, you know, meetings or focus group discussions, and how to actually come up with something meaningful to, you know, invite policy change and policy making. So that was the, you know, main job that I worked in. But I've also have took some specific interest on a parallel line in translation and interpreting. As I, you know, watch my English improving, but also finding those pockets of knowledge in language and enjoying being a biliterate, you know, person. I also have taken some time off from work altogether to focus on my family. We often forget that, you know, caring for young children could be a full-time role that requires a lot of focus and attention. And I've been doing that, you know, on and off, over the years.
You must be a really busy person, juggling a lot of roles and hats.
True. So there are, you know, other, you know, people, many people who are in the same boat, and I salute them for, you know, trying to be on top of everything while we are going into a lot of uncertainties in our lives at the moment.
Yeah, and I know that you did cover a lot about experiences living in New Zealand, but do you have any final thoughts about your experience and your story about living here in Otepote, Dunedin?
Of course. I mean, I have to say that for Muslim women, we are quite identifiable. You know, we wear a headscarf, you know, for modesty, and which also, you know, signals that that's our faith. My experience have always been overwhelmingly positive so far. And I have to say, you know, people don't take a lot of interest in, you know, labeling you. But also I realize that there is way more into who we are, our identities. So faith is one element, you know, but I'm also, you know, an Arabic speaker. I'm Palestinian. I am Kiwi. I'm also a human being on top of all of that. And as I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, you would be surprised that, you know, how much we share with, you know, other faiths and other ethnic groups, way more than what divide us or, you know, put us apart. So it has been positive overall. And I'm always mindful of what makes us a society. I mean, we appreciate our diversity in unity and our unity in diversity. So New Zealand is not a melting pot. We don't assimilate people. We cherish their cultures and we appreciate that. You know, some incidents from time to time threatens to make a rupture in our social cohesion. And I can, you know, mention what happened in March 15, 2 years ago, and also what happened recently at the Lynn Mall in Auckland, where it was quite a worrying time for many Muslims, many people who are originally from Sri Lanka, many people who are, you know, former refugees, how that does not define who we are and how we are committed as, you know, law-abiding citizens to serve our communities and to belong to this land as, you know, our home. So, yeah, I'm mindful of all these, you know, events. And I think we are on, you know, a good pathway to that, but we still have a lot of work to do as well.
Yeah,
that's all what I'm going to say.
Thank you so much for your reflections. And thank you for being here today on our show, Dr. Rula.
Thank you very much, Arina. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That is the end of our program today. Thank you for your time. Special thank you to ORFM for facilitating the production of this program. I should add that the views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of Otago Muslim Chaplaincy as such. If you have any questions, feel free to email muslimchaplaincy@otago.ac.nz. We hope to see you next time, inshallah, God willing. Assalamu alaikum. You've been listening to Muslim Chaplaincy Conversation at OARFM Dunedin.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.